Right now, new advancements in genetic science have made it possible for scientists to know more about our ancestors from around the world than ever before. Today, we'll find out what we're learning about Vikings.
We'll check out those latest discoveries along with a debate about how we use antibiotics, as well as talk to our famous and favorite science writer at Central Time.
Gemma Tarlak is a senior editor at Discover Magazine based in Waukesha. Gemma, welcome back to the show.
Hello. It's great to be with you again.
We're going to start with the Vikings. Who's going to play quarterback? Oh, I'm sorry. Wrong Vikings.
These are the Vikings that people care about.
Right. Exactly. So we're learning a lot about Vikings. First, talk about the tools that are out there that we're getting this new information from.
Yeah, well, this is a really fascinating and very hot field within Viking Age research. And, you know, if you think about how do we find out things about the Vikings, you probably think that somebody goes with a shovel to a site in Iceland or Norway or Sweden, and they start digging, and they start looking for pieces of a boat or other, artifacts or maybe even human remains. But the fact is that the really hot and exciting area of Viking Age research now is all done with DNA. And it's coming from a few different sources. You can look at modern populations and look at their DNA and kind of trace back their ancestry, which is what, you know, many of us do with those tests that are so popular right now. But you can also actually extract ancient DNA from these remains that are more than 1,000 years old. And the techniques are just getting so good now that we're learning more and more and more from this ancient DNA. And my favorite area of this research is actually ancient and modern DNA from sources other than humans that is telling us about humans. And what I mean by that, the researchers are able to extract DNA, both again from modern and ancient populations of animals and plants. And based on those findings, they are able to deduce certain things about Viking travel patterns, which to me is just fascinating.
Right, and this is so Viking. One of the things they're using is ancient cod bones, like the fish.
Yeah, and I love this this line of research. They found all these ancient cod bones that were in these settlements in Germany. Not necessarily Viking settlements at all, but they were just settlements in Germany and other areas of Central Europe where people were eating cod. And they looked at these cod bones found at these settlements and got the DNA from the bones and were able to figure out that the actual cod came from an archipelago in Arctic Norway called Lofoten. And it is a beautiful, beautiful place. And they have a very ancient cod tradition. And they figured out that the Vikings started up this cod trade network that persists even today.
Wow. Now, are we learning stuff that is placing Vikings in the pre-medieval era in places we didn't know where they were?
Yes. In fact, my favorite study out of all of the ones that I looked at while I was writing the story, it's about the Viking mice, the littlest Vikings. and basically, there are all these little islands that are barely more than specks of land in the Atlantic Ocean. Specifically, I'm looking at Madeira, which is now part of Portugal. But we thought for a long time that the first Europeans to arrive at Madeira were the Portuguese. So a researcher some years ago who was looking at modern mice on that island was testing their DNA and expected to find that they were descended from mice that had lived in Portugal. And he found something very different. He actually found that the mice had, on this island that we thought would be Portuguese mice, the mice actually had genetic signatures of Viking Age Norwegian mice. So they think what happened, there's no historical document, there is no wrecked longboat or Viking grave on the island, but they think that what happened was a Viking ship, maybe either exploring or getting blown off course, ended up on this island and, stop for a while to maybe get some fresh water, get some more food, and then left. But unfortunately, or fortunately, depending on how you look at it, the mice that were hitchhiking on the ship took a little shore leave and never made it back to the boat and ended up living on this island for perpetuity. So, it's really fascinating that not only what we can deduce from ancient and modern DNA, but the fact that we don't need, say, human remains to tell us that humans were at a site.
Gemma, are we being too quick to roll out like little mice building tiny longboats themselves and going all over the Atlantic? I mean, I know we don't have direct evidence. Could it be? I'll take that as a no.
you work on developing that theory in your spare time, buddy.
So the exciting thing here is what we can do with DNA in tracing, not just Vikings and their mice, but populations all around the world. How far back can we go, though? What is the, I don't think half-life is the right word, but how far back can we still test something for its DNA?
Well, just to extract DNA and to sequence it, you know, they're able to do it now with some specimens that are more than 500,000 years old. The problem is the further back you go in time, the more natural degradation there is, because as soon as the organism dies, microbes start getting in there and just feasting. And in addition to destroying the DNA, a lot of times bacteria and other life forms kind of leave their own genes mixed in with the genes of the organism that has died. So they're getting better all the time. I mean, just in the past 5 or so years, they have pushed back that date by hundreds of thousands of years. So we're still kind of at that, you know, 500,000 mark, and that's only for DNA that has been preserved under the perfect conditions, which is basically a dry condition that's cold. So you need dry and you need cold to preserve DNA. So that's why it's so tricky the further back you go in the fossil record.
And it sounds like if I'm a scientist who wants to study the movement of people around the world, I don't need to go out right now. Maybe my priority isn't to go out and find new sites. I want to start going to the natural history museums and the labs and the archives, right? Because there's got to be a lot of stuff out there that hasn't been DNA tested.
Yes, there is. I've written before on other stories where they are looking at museum samples now that have been just, you know, sitting in back rooms for sometimes centuries and testing them for DNA. And that is a very promising area of research, but the issue with that is always what archaeologists and anthropologists call the provenance of an item. You have to be clear that you are testing an item that has kind of a really good chain of custody, that you know where it was found and how it was handled the whole way from when it was excavated to being put on the museum shelf, just because, you know, things can get very easily contaminated. But we have a lot of material that has good provenance, that does have a chain of custody, and is now actually being tested for DNA extraction and analysis.
One more question before we move on from this, Gemma. What question, Viking or otherwise, around the world, are you hoping gets solved by this DNA testing?
I know you're going to ask me about building a time machine.
No time machines today, I promise.
Well, you know, I mean, my thing about science is that I just like watching it advance, being able to see it advance, and being able to see old theories get refined or sometimes overturned. I just really like kind of the progress of our understanding. So there's not one particular question. I'm just really excited that this is a whole new area that researchers can now explore.
Talking to Gemma Tarlak from Discover Magazine, looking at some of the most cool stories from the world of science over the last few months. Gemma, let's switch gears here and talk about antibiotics. Now, if I get antibiotics from a doctor, I think the label always says, keep taking this stuff, even if you feel better halfway through. You know, they more medical jargony than that, but that's the gist. That's open to debate, I understand it.
Yeah, and you know, fortunately, I don't have to go to the doctor often, but I know when I do, they always tell you, in addition to what it says in the bottle, like, you have to take this, you have to take this, you have to take this till there are none left. And it turns out that there was a recent commentary in one of the most respected medical journals out there, the BMJ, and the author said, hey, you know, we have actually known for decades that stopping antibiotics early does not cause resistance in antibiotics. And this, you know, when I read this commentary, my mind was blown because I thought, we've known about this for decades? What? But yeah, it turns out that there is a lot of evidence that actually taking antibiotics longer increases a risk that they'll develop resistance. And so this is kind of the view that's emerging now, and I think it's very important for anyone listening out there and taking antibiotics, don't just quit. Don't go cold turkey, because
right,
this is not settled science. But basically, there is a growing camp within the field saying, hey, we're giving people the wrong message, and they should actually stop taking antibiotics when they feel better. Now, of course, there is another camp among doctors saying, hang on, we just do not have enough evidence to make this kind of conclusion, to start telling people to stop taking the antibiotics. And their argument, the camp that is arguing, yes, you must finish your antibiotics, they are saying there is not enough research out to be sure that you can quit antibiotics early, that it may actually vary from one type of infection to another. For example, if you have an ear infection and you stop taking your antibiotics midway, you might be at a higher risk of a relapse. So they're calling for more research looking at specific infections and the specific response to the antibiotics for those infections. So the jury is still out as far as I'm concerned, but it's a really interesting thing because I don't know about you, but I kind of thought this was settled science. Apparently not.
Right, and hopefully there is research because the core problem here, antibiotic resistance, is a big deal.
Yes, it's a huge deal. And, you know, there was that poor woman last year who unfortunately passed away who had an infection that was not responsive to any known antibiotic. And, you know, fortunately, this is the wave of the future because antibiotics very quickly develop resistance. And partly it's from overuse, just, you know, being prescribed too many antibiotics, or perhaps antibiotics for something that should not have an antibiotic. So, yeah, there is definitely overuse, but the jury is still out on what is proper use.
I want to turn to one more a column from Discover on end-of-life care and spirituality. What's the connection there?
Yeah, this is, you know, it's a really interesting avenue that I think we don't often talk about either in the pages of a magazine or just in conversation between family and friends or even with your doctor. And it's looking at the impact of spirituality on the quality of life for terminally ill people. And the doctor that our writer follows, Tracy Balboni out of Harvard, she's defining spirituality as a search for meaning and purpose, which may or may not include reference to the divine. So we're not talking necessarily about people who are religious, but just people who are spiritual, whether or not they have religious beliefs. And it's really about the search for meaning, and what they're finding is that can really impact not only a patient's quality of life, but the decisions they make. You know, do you go into hospice? Do you have the advanced directives about care, you know, at that time? And it's very interesting. It's a new field, but it's very interesting the results that she and her colleagues are finding, some of which are pretty counterintuitive.
Like what?
Well, for example, you know, you might think that someone who's deeply religious would be very much okay passing away and go into hospice and, you know, just focus on making their last days comfortable and sort of, you know, be ready to pass away. Where they're finding the more a person goes to outside religious figures for support, such as pastors or fellow parishioners or very religious relatives, that those people are the most likely to end up in an intensive care unit using extreme measures to prolong their life, regardless of, say, levels of pain or quality of life. So that's just one of the findings. And they have this whole new initiative that was just recently launched at Harvard called the Initiative on Health, Religion, and Spirituality. And they're looking at all different ways of addressing this issue with the goal that, you know, individual patients are different, and how can doctors maximize their final days, make them comfortable both physically and just emotionally.
Interesting. Well, Gemma, we'll leave it there. Thanks, as always, for joining us.
Thank you. I'll look forward to the next time.
That's Gemma Tarlak, senior editor at Discover Magazine. She's based in Waukesha.